Welcome to the Industry Talks podcast, the premier podcast for all the best insider info on the music business. I'm your host, Roman Perry. I want to start off by thanking you guys so much for your support. According to our hosting service, we have over 100 unique listeners on this show. If you guys are listening to this on iTunes, please give us 5 stars and maybe leave a friendly comment. That's probably the best way to support what we're doing and, you know, help us get noticed. Our next panel is scheduled for March 19th. For more details, check out our website at industrytalks.net. We hope to see you there. On this episode, recorded in September of last year, we have Josh Berman, the VP of Marketing at Concord Music Group. Listen as we dive into some unorthodox marketing techniques of 2017, why a music business internship is more important than a music business class, and how the music industry has shifted since streaming has become the norm.
Industry Talks.
How's it going?
Good.
Yeah?
Good. Very good. Glad to be here.
It's awesome. I'm glad to have you here. So you're having a baby soon?
Having a baby extremely soon. Well, I'm not. My wife is.
Well, I mean, you know, they say we are pregnant.
Yes. No, yeah. I'm not pregnant. My wife is extremely pregnant. So any minute now.
Yeah. I'm sure that you have that, like, excitement. Is this your first?
Yes.
Yeah.
First, maybe last. We'll see.
All right. That's the excitement. It's probably overwhelming.
It is.
Yeah.
It's pretty intense. So I'm just trying to get stuff wrapped up before D-Day.
Yeah, I'm sure. So why don't you go over a little bit of what you do? We were talking about Concord Music Group a second ago.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe kind of give an outline of like your day-to-day.
And sure.
Like what you're into right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So Concord is kind of a... not an easy entity to explain. The gist of it is it was originally founded as a jazz record label in the 70s in Concord, California, in Northern California. And at some point they started to acquire some defunct label catalogs, so labels that were not around anymore, but they went and bought up the catalog. So they bought up Prestige and Riverside, which is a lot of early Wes Montgomery and John Coltrane and Miles Davis recordings and a bunch of great jazz stuff. And then they partnered with a label called Telarc, which is a lot of classical and some more modern jazz. And then they very quickly became a bigger catalog company than they were a new music company. And did a deal in the late 90s with Starbucks. So they created the Starbucks label, Hear Music.
Okay.
And had some huge successes with what I would call legacy artists. So
right.
Joni Mitchell, John Fogerty, Ray Charles, Paul Simon, Paul McCartney. So they were doing new records from those kind of legendary legacy artists.
Like the tenured artists,
yes.
Basically.
And did incredibly well with those. So they shifted away from being a jazz label to being what I would call kind of an adult music legacy artist label.
Almost adult contemporary?
I wouldn't say adult contemporary. I mean, I guess.
Yeah.
Adult contemporary, kind of that terminology has sort of shot itself in the foot over the years. But yeah, they did incredibly well, selling records to adults, I guess you could say, through Starbucks, through Amazon, Best Buy, iTunes,
yeah.
Throughout the early aughts, and then realized that that allowed them to go and purchase more labels and more catalogs. So they did a deal to purchase Stax Recordings, which is a legendary Memphis soul R&B label. So Isaac Hayes, Otis Redding, Booker T and the MGs, and then just kept expanding and expanding the catalog to the point that they were sitting on such a vast holdings that they decided to get into the new music frontline artist business. So then about 5 years ago is when they started to partner with kind of, I would say, newer artist labels. So the first one was they purchased an Americana and bluegrass label out of Boston called Rounder Records,
okay.
Which is a 40-year-old kind of iconic Americana sort of roots music label.
Yeah.
Moved them down to Nashville. So they're based in Nashville now. They have everything from Alison Krauss to Bella Fleck to we just put out the Greg Allman's final studio recording. Then they partnered with a kind of emo punk label out of Orange County called Fearless Records. It's kind of very Warped Tour kind of punk label. So their big bands are probably I Prevail, Pierce the Veil.
Okay.
They had that band Plain White Tees, and
yeah,
that huge song Delilah back in the day.
Massive hit.
Yes. Then they partnered with a label out of New York called Razor and Tie, which is kind of touches everything, a little bit of rock, a little bit of pop, a little bit of singer-songwriter, but their big holdings, their juggernaut is Kids Bop, which is kids doing pop covers.
Yeah.
And it is,
I remember the commercials,
massive.
Yeah.
They have their own Sirius XM channel. They have, you know, international properties, Kids Bop UK, Kids Bop Germany. They have a tour. They actually just did a tour with the Kids Bop kids.
Really?
Sold out the Greek Theater in LA. It sold out, I think it was Jones Beach in New York. So that's I had never heard of it until I started working at Concord.
But that's that is like a massive.
It's a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah,
apparently, I don't have kids yet, but apparently, if you have kids and, you know, and tweens and young, like, adolescent toddlers, they love it.
Well, so I remember when I was little, like, watching, you know, Nick and Cartoon Network, and those, they'd always advertise on
totally
those, and like
that's a big deal. They're probably one of the few properties that you know, because Concord's, it's all independent labels. We don't do pop, we don't do hip hop,
right?
We don't do, you know, sort of really big commercial radio acts, so we don't advertise on TV. We don't have the budgets to do, but Kids Bop, they do a lot of television advertising.
Yeah, that's nuts,
that's their core audience is Nickelodeon, Disney. So yeah, so that's Razor and Tie. Then they did the deal with Loma Vista, which was my previous label. So
okay.
Loma Vista is Tom Wally's independent label. So
yeah.
Tom's a legend, co-founded Interscope with Jimmy Iovine in the 90s, was the chairman of Warner Brothers, ushering in the era of Linkin Park and Josh Groban and Michael Bublé and kind of Green Day's resurgence and all that fun stuff. So Loma Vista is sort of the cool kind of frontline indie label as part of Concord. So acts like St. Vincent, Little Dragon, Health. We did that Iggy Pop record with Josh Homme last year. Who else? DJ DS. So it's a lot of, and we actually have an amazing hip hop artist named Denzel Curry from Miami.
Who's, all right. Yeah, I've heard of him.
Yeah, he's starting to blow up. So so that's a really interesting, fun label. And then last but not least is, second to last is Concord Records. So Concord Records, the entity still exists as a record label.
Right.
And it's not just jazz anymore. They still do jazz, but they do stuff like Esperanza Spalding.
Okay.
You know, so they do sort of really unique kind of modern jazz. They still have stuff like Chick Corea and Mike Stern, but they've really expanded over the last few years. So they actually put out the New Pornographers record last year, which is a great iconic indie rock band.
Yeah.
They recently signed Lindsay Sterling, who is, how do I describe Lindsay? She is a electronica violinist who is massive in her world. She it's instrumental violin music with beats, basically, but she has garnered massive following all by her own. She's never had a record label. So she has her own publishing company. She started her own record label.
Really?
Done her own stuff for the past 10 years and built it into this juggernaut. She's got 10 million YouTube followers, multi-million Spotify followers. She's just able to sell hundreds of thousands of records every
time
out,
man,
on her own.
Yeah.
But she's putting out a holiday record this year, and she actually wanted a label partner. So I'm excited she chose Concord. Anyway, so those are the six kind of frontline labels. And then there's Kraft Recordings. So Kraft Recordings is essentially the umbrella that encompasses all of the catalog. So everything I just talked about, Riverside, Fantasy, Stax, Telarc, and then Random. You know, we just did a license for the REM catalog, so we own all the REM stuff. Delicious Vinyl, Nitro Records, it all falls under Kraft, kind of like Rhino Records does for Warner Brothers, Kraft is for us. So that is the setup. Oh, I forgot one. Fantasy Records is one of the seven labels. So Fantasy was originally Creedence Clearwater Revival's label, which we bought the catalog for. Then we resurrected the imprint for certain new music artists like Nathaniel Rateliff, Valerie June. We just put out the Lucas Nelson Records, Willie Nelson's son, who's fantastic. Anyway, so like I said, it's not easy to describe what Concord is. So Concord is these seven different independent record labels that all flow through what we call our centralized services. So it's kind of like label services that a lot of distributors offer, except we're not a distributor. We are a record label unto ourselves. So we have allowed all of the seven labels to completely keep their culture and their autonomy, and their staff.
Yeah.
So all the labels have a label head, a GM, A&R, marketing people. Some have digital people, some don't. And then for everything else, it flows through Concord. So the makeup of the shared services is sync licensing, pitching to film, television, video games, trailers, all that stuff. Sales, old school sales, making calls to stores, getting CDs and vinyls in the stores, which is still viable business for us.
Yeah.
Radio, really robust radio promotion department. They've got about 20 some odd people spread around the country pitching to everything from non-commercial, AAA, the KCRWs of the world, all the way up to, we have this band, The Revivalists, that's actually in the top 40 charts right now. So
that's great.
And everything in between. Yeah, a bunch of, there's an international department. They liaise with all the international affiliates around the world.
Yeah.
There's a digital department. So it's a stream, kind of streaming department, plus digital marketing. And then a lot of the sort of back office stuff, royalties, finances. But what they didn't have until recently was a marketing department sort of connecting the dots between all of those various departments. Everything was somewhat siloed as far as, oh, I do radio, I do sales, I do digital, I do sync. So I came in May to ostensibly connect the dots between all those departments from a marketing standpoint. So making sure that all the projects have the sort of the best process to access all of their shared services, depending on what the project is. If it's something that's really developing and building an audience, most of that development comes from the labels itself. And as things start to build, then more and more of the departments at Concord can come in and help add their services. Sometimes if it's a developing thing that has something really popping at radio, it's my job to make sure that the sync license team and the digital team can see that, so we can feed that information to them. So maybe they can hop on something that's happening. If you're reading the data that we just got a big ad in Colorado at the, you know, KBCO, then I can tell the streaming team, let's look at what's happening on, you know, in streaming in Colorado, because you know, there's something happening at radio there. So basically just connecting the dots between all those
shared
services. Yes. As for what a day in my life looks like, it is pretty nuts considering seven labels, 120 plus releases a year. You know, it's hard to, it's hard to sort of get through every single project, but it's been super fun kind of jumping in on stuff that's just getting going and helping it get from the ground floor to, you know, a 5 or a 10, and then stuff that's at a 5 or a 10, helping that get to a 50, and then the stuff that's ready to just blow, kind of all hands on deck. It's fun to just run around the building lighting fires. So,
yeah.
So far, so good. I've been there about 4 months. Yeah, it's good group of people. Good. You know, I like that we're independent. We're big, as far as independents go, but we're still not beholden to any kind of corporate policies, corporate culture. You know, we're agile enough to, if we have an idea at 10 a.m. and the budget to pull it off and we have the approval to do it, we can pull it off, you know, by noon. We don't have to wait for a bunch of lawyers or major labels to tell us what to do.
So you guys are like a, just like an independent conglomerate, almost like you've pooled resources between all these different independent labels.
Basically,
it's brilliant. Actually,
it's a really good setup, and the timing could not be better because they essentially bought low. You know, they started this whole move
right
as the shit was hitting the fan with the Napster era and the download era and the piracy era. So when everyone was pulling the panic cord, and all the smartest guys in the building were panicking and running around with the sky is falling kind of mentality, these guys just held out and started to just build a catalog, build frontline labels, to the point that now there's light at the end of the tunnel as far as revenue projections go and artist development and careers, you know, not just being based on touring anymore, but you can actually make a living monetizing YouTube streaming. You know, record sales are still there. I know a lot of labels have just completely given up on physical products, but we still have a robust business there. Yeah. So,
well, especially with the types of artists that you have.
Yeah, it's true. You know? I mean, you think about like some of these niche genres. I hate to say that, but it's the truth.
Everything is niche. Nowadays,
blues,
man.
Jazz, Americana, folk. Even rock, you know. I mean, if you look at the major streaming services like Spotify and Apple Music, they're so driven by hip-hop and pop. So even rock kind of takes a backseat to those. But we've got a ton of rock acts that are doing incredibly well. So yeah, it's fun. It's a fun time to be at Concord.
Yeah, I'm sure. So you definitely said a lot of stuff that I want to dig into a little bit later, especially about just data and breaking artists and breaking new releases and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But could you maybe just shed some light on your own journey, like through the music industry and like
sure.
kind of how you got to where you are today and basically like how you managed to position yourself to the role you're at Concord.
Cool. Yeah, absolutely. So, well, as you know, I played music with your brother, Adrian,
yep.
Back in high school and college. So I grew up in LA playing drums, mostly rock stuff, and then got pretty serious about it later on in high school. I had a drum teacher that sort of convinced me to play jazz. At the time, I hated jazz.
Yeah.
I thought it was four different guys playing four songs at the same time. but he convinced me that the sort of the best musicians in the world are jazz musicians who can also play rock or
John Bonham.
Anything else. Yes.
Yeah.
Truth. So, so he kind of backdoored me into loving jazz by showing me Steely Dan and the Meters and Chick Corea, Return to Forever and all that fusion stuff. So anyway, so I got heavy, heavy into jazz, ended up going to music school. I went to University of Miami in Florida, studied, it's a Bachelor of Arts in what's called Studio Music and Jazz. So it's essentially preparing you to be a professional jazz musician. So you can sight read charts, play commercial jingles, play in bands, play in the studio, get studio gigs. So I did that for 3 years, ended up realizing it's incredibly hard to be a professional jazz musician. I saw guys who could play circles around me move to New York and just fail. So I just figured that's probably not for me. I wasn't that guy that was just in the practice shed for 4 hours a day.
Yeah,
so
I feel you.
So I knew it would be tough, but I didn't realize how tough it would be. The gigs I was getting down there, I wasn't really digging. So I ended up shifting over to music business, the music business school at Miami, which is a pretty reputable program there. Did that for 2 semesters and realized that it was just not for me. I wasn't really happy in Miami. I wasn't really happy with, you know, the playing I was doing. So ended up leaving, moving back home to L.A., playing in a couple bands, kind of tooling around for a bit. And my dad actually suggested that I just try to get an internship at a record label, which I never had wanted to do. I just, you know, I always thought my office was going to be my drum set on a stage somewhere. But he convinced me to give it a shot. So I ended up getting an internship at Warner Brothers Jazz when there was a jazz department at Warner Brothers Records here in Burbank. It does not exist anymore. But I immediately fell in love with it. I was immediately working with some of the legendary artists that I had loved and studied in college: Pat Metheny, Josh Redman, Kenny Garrett, Christian McBride, Brad Meldow. So I immediately fell in love with it and worked my ass off. I started the first ever jazz college street team at Warner Brothers. So I was basically hitting up all my friends who were still in college and saying, "Hey, Josh Redman's coming through town. I'll give you a bunch of tickets if you go flyer the shit out of campus." And it was great. So so ended up doing that for a few years. They ended up closing the jazz department because most major labels closed their jazz departments. This would have been 2002. So this is right when piracy was just causing everyone to yeah. panic. And the recorded music industry was shrinking 20 to 25% year yeah. over year.
The bubble was just fully bursting.
It had just gone from the highest revenue in the history of recorded music. I think it was something like $64 billion in 1999. And by 2002, it was half that. So,
right.
So they closed the jazz department, but Nonesuch Records, which was part of the same Warner Music Group, ended up actually acquiring about a half dozen of those jazz contracts, of those artists that were recently didn't have a home. So they picked up Brad Meldow, Josh Redman, Pat Metheny, Kenny Garrett, and Nicholas Payton, and the chairman of Nonesuch asked Tom Wally, who was at the time the chairman of Warner Brothers, if there was anyone who was left from the shrapnel of the jazz department who would want to be the new jazz marketing person at Nonesuch. And to his credit, Tom suggested me. He didn't know me that well. I just think he knew that I worked hard and that I was young, single, didn't have a wife or a kid or anything tying me to LA, and I would be willing to move to New York, which is where the job was based. So ended up getting the job at Nonesuch, moved there in 2004. I started as the sort of jazz marketing guy, but very quickly pivoted to work on a lot of the other stuff. Nonesuch is a really amazing label. It was started as a classical label by Jack Holtzman in the 60s. Jack founded Elektra Records and signed The Doors and Aretha Franklin. And he's just a complete legend. He started Nonesuch as kind of a side project just to put out funky classical records, and ended up kind of going out of business in the 70s, and then a guy named Bob Hurwitz resurrected it in the 80s and turned it into an incredibly eclectic kind of new music label. So everything from Caetano Veloso to Philip Glass to Steve Reich to the Gypsy Kings, a lot of African music, Ali Farka Touré and Amadou and Mariam and Youssou N'Dour. Anyway, so I ended up working a lot of that interesting eclectic stuff. And then they had stuff like Wilco and Emmylou Harris and Randy Newman and Katie Lang. It was a lot of those legacy artists as well. And then they signed the Black Keys. So I became the Black Keys guy and sort of saw what it was like to really develop an act from sort of a pitchfork band that had had some success into just an absolute juggernaut of rock success. Anyway, so I was in Nonesuch for about 6 years doing marketing stuff. I did some international, a little bit of A&R, but mostly I've always just done marketing at labels. After 6 years of that, I ended up getting a job at Warp Records, which is one of my favorite record labels of all time, and I could not turn down the opportunity to work there. So Warp is a British independent electronic label. Founded in Sheffield in the late 80s. It's now based in London. I ran the New York office. So I ran the U.S. office out of New York. And Warp is just a fiercely independent, idiosyncratic collection of people and artists. So they kind of ushered in what's called the IDM era in the 90s. So that's intelligent dance music. It's music that is not intended purely for the clubs. It was intended to kind of listen to after you got home from the rave, to kind of vibe out to. So everything from Boards of Canada to Aphex Twin, Square Pusher, LFO, Nightmares on Wax. So it was a really, really incredible place of just very creative, very artistic, unique people and artists. So that was an incredible experience. And a tiny label. I mean, I had a staff of 3 when I started and a staff of 5 when I left. There was about 20 people in London and we had 5 people in New York. So, but that was where I got my first taste of actually running a record label. So I started there as the PR and marketing guy. And then my boss ended up leaving, so I took over as the label manager and had to do everything from cutting distribution deals with Canada and U.S. distributors to figuring out brand partnership agreements and, helping on recording contracts and a lot of stuff, you know, the sort of financial health of the company, sort of looking at all the revenue streams and what are the trends and what's working, what's not working kind of thing. So that was a really good crash course because I'd never really taken proper business courses. So I kind of learned on the job, but it was a fascinating way to do it.
It's the best way to do it. I think just right into the fire.
Yeah. I mean, I think I actually said this at the industry panel. But, you know, I took 2 semesters of music business courses, and this is nothing against University of Miami. I think this is true across the board for any program. I don't care what it is you're learning. I mean, I learned more as an intern at Warner Brothers in 2 weeks than I did in 2 semesters at college. And that's because you're in it. You're thrown into it. You're thrown into situations and you have to figure out what to do, how to solve problems. And you don't really have those issues in school. You know, you're reading about copyright law and things like that, but you know,
case studies.
Right. Yes. A lot of white label papers. Anyway, so I was at Warp for another 5 years or so, having a blast. I mean, that electronic music culture, living in New York, going to clubs, having shows that didn't start till 2 or 3 in the morning, and it's quite a lifestyle. I enjoyed every minute of it, traveling to London and going to you know, amazing festivals in Spain and Paris and Poland, and it was a lot of fun, but ended up I knew I wanted to move back to LA, and when I moved to New York, it was always going to be temporary. I didn't think it would be 10 years, but I was kind of hankering to come back to LA, and I had convinced Warp to open an LA office, which they very much needed anyway. Their flagship artist on the label in a lot of ways is an artist named Flying Lotus, who's sort of the epicenter of the beat culture in LA. Has worked with everyone from Kendrick to Herbie Hancock to Thundercat is kind of one of his proteges. So we had just re-signed Fly Low. I thought it was very important to have a presence in Los Angeles, not just for Fly Low and the kind of all the culture that he represented.
What year was this?
So I moved back here in 2015, end of 2014.
Okay.
The funny thing, the ironic thing is when I left LA in 2004, that's when Low End Theory had just started. That's right. That's when Fly Low had just done his first EPs. The whole like LA underground beat culture was just starting to get off the ground, and that's right when I left. And I missed the whole like development of it. So by the time I came back, it was like, you know, it was no longer underground. I mean, it's a huge deal. Yeah. So,
I mean, it's like still, I mean, just that whole scene has like grown so much in LA. There's like so many, I mean, there's probably like a half a dozen of those style of club nights that are just like just as massive as, you know, just as massive as Low End Theory was in their own right, in their own, you know, respectful space.
It's clearly permeated pop culture. I mean, if you think about, you know, half the guys on the Kendrick Lamar To Pimp a Butterfly record are all part of that kind of LA jazz-influenced beat scene. So Warp greenlit the LA office about 6 weeks before I made the move. I got a call from my friend Ryan Wally, who's Tom Wally's son, is head of A&R at Loma Vista, asking me if I knew anyone who would be interested in being the label manager at Loma Vista. Unbeknownst to him, he didn't know I was moving to LA, and I knew that Loma Vista was based in LA. I'd obviously been paying close attention since they had launched in 2012, quickly snatching up some of my favorite artists on the planet: St. Vincent, Little Dragon, Health, I really love. I kind of put my name in the hat for that gig, ended up getting it. So I made sure things were as tight up as possible at Warp, and I moved over to Loma Vista. So that was January of 2015. And I was label manager there, and was there for 2.5 years or so. And then, Concord, Loma Vista's part of Concord, and I think a lot of people at Concord sort of realized they needed a marketing department there to help connect the dots. And they asked me to do it, and I was happy to do it. I still get to work with all the Loma Vista artists, which is great. But now I get to work with a ton of other stuff, which is really fun.
Was that difficult leaving Loma Vista?
It was. I mean, Loma Vista reminds me of Warp in a lot of ways. It's five people for the world.
It's very agile.
It's fiercely independent. They really only want to work with artists who have created their own sound, have created their own culture around what they do, write their own music, are album-centric artists for the most part, not single-centric artists. They have a very... they have a very fierce, fiercely defended stance on artwork, the message behind or the intent behind why an artist is making a record, and then everything that surrounds that message in bringing it to the marketplace. So making sure that everything from the photos to the album artwork to the music videos to the banner ads.
Yeah.
So the show flyer invites, you know, the digital flyers that we make to invite people to shows, everything has this through line of high quality and continuing whatever the intent of the message was for why the artist wrote the record in the first place.
Yeah.
Which in a lot of ways is how Warp approaches it. So spending a little bit more money on photographs, a little bit more money on packaging, even if that's not the majority of where the revenue is going to come from, it's very important to tell that story through all of those assets, while obviously letting the music do most of the speaking. I think, you know, it's a really creative, almost like an agency approach, like holistically how you tell that story, how you bring that record to the marketplace through everything that it touches.
Yeah. I mean, you can tell that, like, even just going to the Loma Vista website, like, mm-hmm. there's an artistic, even behind, I think, all of the artists that you guys represent, I think there's a through line of the record label as well, and like what the record label brings and the umbrella that, you know, the record label has. You know, like, you can tell it's a Loma Vista artist.
Totally. I mean, it's musically, it's all over the place,
from definitely
Marilyn Manson to Denzel Curry,
right,
to, you know, DJ DS, which is an electronic duo. But yeah, that that the A&R looks at it that way for sure. And then we did the same from a marketing and a creative standpoint. So yeah, that, and it just, that it seems like that culture is somewhat rare in the modern music industry, especially in the major label world.
100%.
There are some great people there. There are some amazing artists there. But I just don't think that model works for the way that they're set up.
No.
So keeping your overhead small, so you have the ability to maybe, you know, eat into your margins a bit to make a foil stamped embossed vinyl, as opposed to just slamming out the cheapest thing you can.
100%.
So, and look, you know, it's not always, it does, it's not always the case. Sometimes you won't, you know, we have this amazing punk band called Show Me the Body, and sometimes you just need to get a cheap piece of vinyl out there, you know, because you know that fan base is not going to spend $30, you know, on a nice double gatefold vinyl.
Yeah. I mean, you got to go with what works.
Right. I mean, you know? No, yeah, knowing the audience is another thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, I definitely, I miss being in it and scrapping it up with the Loma guys every day, but, certainly still get to work with all those artists, still in touch with the Loma folks every day. And, yeah, I'm loving expanding my horizons and kind of getting back into the jazz world now, because there's so much jazz flowing through Concord.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a return to my roots, which is great.
That's awesome. So I do have a question. Marilyn Manson is just about to release his new record.
Correct.
And he has a single out, which I listened to today. It's pretty good. I was into it.
Cool.
So what's the process like now that you are kind of, you know, the marketing guy for Concord and you work with Loma Vista? Like, what was the process like for releasing the single? And then also, like, I don't know what you can talk about or what you can't talk about. Like, what's the process like for releasing that record that's going to be coming out?
Sure. So the approach that Concord has is that the true marketing plan should come from the people at the label, at the proper labels themselves. So I'm no longer at Loma Vista. They signed Manson. They, you know, the A&R staff helped make the record. Creative director, head of marketing helped, you know, connect the dots with an art director to tell that message through the artwork and the photos and everything. So they will essentially create their ideal marketing plan kind of internally. And then they'll bring that to the various departments at Concord and say, this is what we want to do. This is what we'd like you guys to help us execute. And that's when we all take a look at that, weigh in, say, hey, this is a great idea. What about this? Or let's add some more to this section. What, you know, I know a guy who can help us with this crazy idea or whatever it is. So it kind of works its way through the various departments at Concord as far as setting up the release. So this is before anything's announced, before the public knows, you know, what's happening. We sort of go top to bottom through their marketing plan and just figure out the best way to execute it or help add to it, help, you know, either create more ideas that based on their ideas, or, you know, if certain things are just simply not possible due to timeframes, due to budgets, figuring out other solutions. Once that's all vetted and done, we circle the wagons and get ready for the initial launch. If the public knew how the sausage was made, I've always been fascinated if people knew how much work goes into releasing a music video, announcing an album, putting up a pre-order. It seems so simple from a consumer, from a user end. It seems very simple. Oh, a new video just popped up on YouTube. Oh, so-and-so just posted on socials that they have a new single out. Or go pre-order my album, go buy the shirt bundle with a vinyl LP bundle on my web store. There's so much work. It still baffles my mind 15 years in. It still blows my mind.
The amount of people that are involved.
There's so many balls in the air. There's so much heavy lifting. There's so many facets of a record because you've got the artist, a manager, a booking agent. You've got a merch company, usually. So you've got all these various designs and things and elements, and the booking agent and the promoters need the tour ad mat. The merch company needs the merch designs. The record label owns a lot of that content that is being used for these various designs. So you've got to have licenses in place or at least agreements on how things can and can't be used or what, you know, what should be used as far as, like I said, telling that story. And then you've got to make a music video, which is insanely difficult. It's just the amount of times I've read a really good treatment and then seen the video and it's not good, makes me sad. So, anyway, so you've got all these plans in place. I think for Manson, we launched with that song, We Know Where You Fucking Live. And Loma Vista had an awesome idea to essentially send drone footage of a certain number of fans who had signed up for the Manson newsletter or had bought something from the Manson web store. So we had their addresses. So we sent them, without anything being announced, a footage of their house or whatever address they had put in with a drone flying over it saying, we know where you fucking live.
Is that legal?
Probably not, but no one complained. It was very cool.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure if you're like a Manson, like if you're a fan, you're going to be like, what the fuck?
There's this genius hacker coder guy who built the whole thing for us. He's done a lot of really interesting stuff over the years. So
brilliant.
It wasn't perfect, but it was really cool. And they had, they had given the addresses over just by buying the product from Manson. So anyway, so that was a very cool initiative. And then, then you've got that little teaser thing, I guess you could call it. And then you've got the launch of the video. Then you've got whatever interview promo around it. He did a Zane Lowe piece on Beats One. He was on Howard Stern. You've got the album announcement, the pre-order, all that stuff tied into, trying to create as much of a moment as possible. I think a big part of marketing anything these days, but particularly records, because we live in this sort of consumption attention economy, where in the good old days, you'd put out a record and then you'd hope that people bought it. And when they bought it, that was it. End of transaction.
And
I didn't care if they
product.
Yeah. I didn't care if they opened the shrink wrap or not. Our relationship is done. You bought the product.
Yeah.
Now it's an attention economy where I need you to go back again and again and again and again and keep streaming that record and keep engaging and keep coming back for whatever reason. So it's much more difficult now, but it's also a lot of fun because now
there's so much more creativity that it allows.
The end of the process is not, oh, you bought the record. There really is no end to the process. It's continuing to find new ways to develop the project, create content, create, remixes, different versions of the song, different versions of the video, different versions of the artwork. Just keep people engaged through all the channels we can reach fans now. And the artists who have bought into that are having a lot of fun. It's definitely, I think hip-hop culture has really shown everyone the way. You can't always be Lil Uzi Vert or Drake, but I think their use of social media to reach their fans, their ability to constantly keep telling the story through just hopping on someone else's track, doing collabs, just figuring out new ways to keep themselves present and create moments is critically important. So that's sort of where we come in. The label comes up with a marketing plan. We'll help execute it, and then we'll help try to find out, how many beats can we get between now and when the street date is? And then once it's out, now we're in phase two. How do we continue to create moments around big festival plays, other looks on the record? If we know we have a big media hit, a big, NPR piece or a Howard Stern interview, how do we create the biggest moment possible out of that? And that's really what we're trying to do every day.
That's nuts. Yeah, the drones at fans' houses is probably the most interesting use of data I've seen.
That was certainly an interesting one. That was a lot of fun. That's the other thing now is we've got access to all of this data, and finding interesting ways to use it is, it's a full-time job essentially.
Now I was going to ask you how you guys use data, and that's answers my question. You're getting really creative with it.
Yeah. I mean, we want it to be as fun for the fan as possible. I mean, a really big thing in selling any kind of product on the internet right now is retargeting. So if you've ever noticed, you've gone to a artist's website or any product website, and then you go check the weather, and then you get fed an ad for the website that you were just on. It's the same thing as Google feeding you an ad. Six weeks ago, you looked up what the weather is in Lake Tahoe, and then all of a sudden you're being fed ski resort ads when you go to Google. So,
dude, I've sent emails through Gmail, and then I see targeted ads pop up. Like, I'm it freaks me out sometimes, but it's also just like this is the world as it is today. So you just kind of are just,
very well put. It is freaky, but it is the world we live in today. The only way to avoid it is to literally go dark.
Yeah.
Do not have any social media accounts. Do not have an email account, or just use the dark web. Just use a Tor browser, basically, that can't track you. So finding unique ways to do retargeting is a lot of fun. So one of the departments at Concord that reports to me is the advertising department. And I'm a big fan of basically if we know. So Manson was on Howard Stern last week. He's got this Justin Bieber quote unquote controversy, where Bieber said something along the lines of, you know, I made you relevant again, because he was wearing a Marilyn Manson t-shirt.
Right.
So there's some really good quotes from that Stern interview. So something that I love to do is, if you've gone to the Marilyn Manson website, you're now, you know, capable of being retargeted to, because we, you know, we would hope to remind you that on October 6th that the record is out. So if you haven't bought it yet, it's out now.
Right.
But instead of just blasting the internet with out now, buy now, I would love to do something. I love doing something that's more cryptic, like just having the upside down cross logo that's from the new Manson album, without actually saying that it's Marilyn Manson, but then just having a quote from the Justin Bieber controversy.
Right.
So you're connecting the dots between someone who maybe clicked on the link that Manson posted to the Stern interview on his socials. So we know someone likely heard that interview.
Right.
And then when the week the record comes out, you have some cryptic thing that references that interview, but doesn't just say, give me money, buy now. So that kind of stuff, I enjoy coming up with sort of fun, creative ways.
And then also, once they see the record with the symbol on it, they're going to recognize it.
Right.
And they're going to end up gravitating towards it.
Exactly. And that's what dovetails back to the really strong creative.
Yeah.
So they've created this new logo for Manson. It's kind of like a crucifix. It's like an upside down cross with two lines. It's very stark. It's like Manson has a huge tattoo of it on his hand now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a really cool kind of modern graphic image. And so I like just kind of blasting that around and just making people like, what is that? How do I know that?
Yeah.
Just kind of make it a little more interesting than, you know, it may not be the most obvious marketing technique. I'm sure most people would say, like, don't you just want to say album out now? Click here for Spotify or iTunes. But we do that too. But I like having a little more fun with it.
Yeah. I mean, subtlety is like, I don't know. I think everything is so loud because, like I said before, like we talked about, you're competing for people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
So having something that's subtle is kind of going against what everybody else is doing.
Totally. I agree. There's a lot of noise out there. There's a lot of digital fuzz, and it's very hard to cut through. And I think, you know, the best campaigns that I've ever been a part of were ones that didn't feel oppressive, the best campaigns I've ever seen as a consumer were ones that didn't feel like I was being pressed from the top down, where someone was just spending tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars marketing something from the top down. But it came from the bottom up. It came from some cool, weird stunt or something that I heard about, that someone told me about, that I had to then go check out. And then someone else said something else about it. You know, you hear about it, and then it's about impressions. Then it's like a friend that I trust told me this is cool, check it out. I check it out. Then I see someone else reference it on a blog that I really love. And then I hear about it, you know, in some podcast that I listen to or whatever it is. So I feel like this is something I really should engage with, because I'm getting a lot of moments or touch points or references that I trust, as opposed to just being blitzed with an ad campaign.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that we try for. It's sadly few and far between.
Yeah.
And really when you get to a certain level, it's kind of hard to avoid doing, you know,
by now,
a generalized advertising campaign. But, you know, some of the most fun ones I've ever done were this Boards of Canada record in 2013 with Warp, where the fans are just so rabid and this band is so cryptic and weird, and they don't really use social media. No one even knew that they were two brothers until like 10 years into their career. They don't tour. but they have this incredibly rabid fan base, so you can have a lot of fun and just kind of pull a, put a thread out there and have a lot of fun
and see who follows it.
Yeah, with people pulling on it, and it wasn't about a, you know, top down marketing campaign. It was about everyone talking about this thing, even people that didn't know the band, just saying, "Oh, did you hear about that thing?" So that's, yeah, that's the goal, I think.
For sure. That's crazy stuff. Definitely. I think that's kind of the future. I mean, that's kind of where I think it's all headed, is this like grassroots kind of movement and mm-hmm. being able to create these grassroots movements. And like what I've noticed too is just like a lot of brands are going to be working with more directly with creators to build things from the ground up and totally. Kind of, because one thing that I've started learning over the past few years is that like people can smell bullshit from mm-hmm. a mile away. And the less you can do bullshit, I think the better. And, you know, the Marilyn Manson drone campaign is like, you're going after fans and they're going to talk about it. And right. you're going to have like the people that are like, oh, that was my house, tell all their friends and stuff like that. And those impressions that you're creating, like, that's like, that's the anti-bullshit.
Totally. Look, you know, as anyone who markets any product,
yeah.
but especially a piece of art, which is an album.
Yeah.
There is a fine line between art and commerce. And,
yeah.
And we are trying to sell a product, but it's not a crayon. It's not paper towels. It's not, you know, window blinds. It's an album. So, you know, it's someone's, hopefully someone's pouring their heart out. Someone worked their asses yeah. off to make that piece of art, in the intention that you will buy it, or you will stream it, or you will go see it live, or buy the t-shirt. So it's very easy to fall into the bullshit side of the category. And, you know, I think that's why a lot of people are getting sick of it. So that's why I think, you know, I spend an inordinate amount of time looking at other campaigns, looking at other products, looking at other, you know, types of commerce, and looking at stuff to avoid for the most part, but also looking at really interesting ways of reaching people that feels organic. Like, oh yeah, I want that. Like, you know, it's becoming increasingly hard, but there's definitely still a way. And look, at the end of the day, the simple best way to get a fan to buy into what is you're doing is make good shit.
Yeah,
whatever your product is, make it as good as you possibly can. Don't worry about your social media followers. Don't worry about who your publicist is, who your radio plugger is. If you have an undeniable hit, guess what? It will be heard. Like, I truly believe that.
Cream rises to the top.
I've seen it so many times. It's harder now because there's so much more noise, and anyone with a laptop can make a record in their bedroom. But it's easier now because that same person can put it on SoundCloud or YouTube and get it heard. You don't need a major distribution channel to get it out there. There's more competition, but there's way more democracy. So if you really have an amazing piece of content, whatever the hell it is, a video, a song, a picture, you know, I truly believe it will get discovered. So,
I have a question. This is something I've been thinking about for a while. With just thinking back about Napster and thinking back about how once the internet kind of became prolific and file sharing became prolific and this whole sharing culture became like the norm. Mm-hmm. And part of me feels like, I mean, this is something I've just thought about, is that the 90s CD record, you know, sales, that was like a bubble. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we're almost settling into what the music industry should be.
Hmm.
And like what the music industry like that actually like, you know, going from, you know, vinyl to tapes and having 8 tracks in there somewhere and then going into CDs, that was actually just like a bubble.
Right.
Because the way that music was shared back in the day is, you know, you heard somebody play it, or you'd buy the sheet and then you'd, you know, copy that sheet down.
Right.
Or like somebody would play you a song, you'd learn it, and then you'd play it for your friends, and it would all be like more of a personal experience and more of a human experience. Mm. And I think that just something that I feel like, do you think that, you know, now we're kind of settling into a more real and human music industry because there's so much more direct access?
That's interesting. I definitely agree with you, even though I've never had that exact thought. But something that has come up for whatever reason, multiple times in the last few weeks, is the notion, I think Lior Cohen wrote a blog piece for Schilling for his new company, YouTube, ostensibly, you know, making up excuses as to why their payouts to artists are so terrible.
Right. And that's a whole other thing.
But what he said, he was trying to say, you know, we should be living in, we should go back to a singles culture, that the album was simply a commercial construct of record labels in the 50s who decided, oh, we can put more records on vinyl, we can put more songs on vinyl now. Well, let's just sell more songs. We can make more money. Now, that may well be the case. I wasn't around in the 50s when, you know, the 45 LP and, you know, the 78 and all those records were being made, and you could add more content to your piece of wax and sell it for more money. But something incredible happened when someone tried to commercialize music and just sell, you know, make more money off of putting more content on it, which is that the album art was formed. So whether or not the album as an art form was created purely for financial reasons or not, it was created. And then you have stuff like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and Deltron 3030 and, you know, nameless artists who have told incredible stories through that art form. So there's no going back just because we live in this attention economy now. Certainly we live in a more singles-based culture now because of YouTube, because of playlisting, and I fully get that. I respect it. I love it. I love working with artists who just bang out singles all the time. But then they put this collection of singles together, and it does tell a story. So I think that there's still a place for both of those things. So I totally agree. However we're settling in now, we are definitely settling in. There's definitely light at the end of the tunnel from the quote-unquote collapse of the last 12 or 15 years. I like the idea of the, you know, subscription rental model where you just have access to every song ever at your fingertips. But when something really, really moves you and you want a bigger piece of it, you go and you buy the vinyl. You go and you buy the shirt. You go to the concert. I think that is a good and sustainable model moving forward, as long as the content partners actually pay the creators the way they should be paid.
Yeah. Like looking at, I recently saw an article that kind of went over the cuts that people get from streaming services, and it's just like pretty. It's pretty abysmal, honest.
It's pretty gnarly. And look, I'm a label guy, so I'm, you know, I think we get dragged through the mud a lot of times.
Of course.
In those scenarios.
Yeah.
You know, the fact is an artist can make a record, put it up directly through TuneCore, and get a slightly bigger piece of that 0.005, you know, half of a penny per stream. And if you are good enough and can make amazing music or build an audience through your music, then using socials and using YouTube communities and things like that, that's more power to you. I think that's an amazing way to do it. The flip side of that is there is so much noise out there. And if you do have something that you believe in and a record label or a manager or a promoter also sees that and believes in it, you're several steps ahead of everyone else, because you then have people who understand, you know, marketing culture, understand radio culture, understand streaming culture, but also just have access. I mean, really, you know, the two things that I feel very strongly about, and again, I'm obviously biased, are because of all the digital noise and all the content and crap being thrown at people every day, we need curators, we need filters, whether that's a writer that you really like, whether that's a podcast you really like, whether that's a radio station, or a record label. And you think about the handful of record labels that are brands unto themselves. They're not brands because the people at the record labels are going, oh, we're a cool brand, let's continue our brand. They're a brand because of their roster. They're a brand because of their artist roster and how they've cultivated that roster. So from Sub Pop to Domino to Warp to you know, Light in the Attic to, you know, all these incredible, you know, Daptone, all these incredible labels. That's the goal, really, is to become a cultural filter through the bands that you sign and then how you nurture them. You know, the other thing that I can say is, you know, streaming is certainly the way that the record industry overall is looking like it's going to be, you know, quote unquote, saved as far as the revenue that record labels can now make across an entire catalog from streaming services is now allowing them to go and invest in A&R and sign new talent. So streaming has really helped right the ship. The problem is, on an individual artist basis, the artists aren't really getting a fair share, or they're not getting, you know, they're not making enough money one-to-one on the streaming services for the most part to allow them to have a career, which means they still have to tour a ton more than I think a lot of artists should, because when they're on the road for 2 or 3 years at a time, they're not making records. They're not honing their writing chops, which is their lifeblood. Yeah. So it's a really chicken and egg kind of situation. And I don't know what the solution is, but I do like the fact that where we've kind of settled seems to be more sustainable than where we were 5 years ago or 10 years ago. That said, having been doing this for 15 years, it has changed every 6 months for the last 15 years. There has been some kind of revolution in the way that we consume music, the way we release records, the way we market records, the way bands create revenue from their content, from their music. It just changes so rapidly, which for me keeps it fun. I mean, I can never, ever say, oh, I know everything. I know what I'm doing. No one knows what they're doing because it changes all the time. Yeah. I love that.
It's a question of how adaptable you can be rather than like how much you actually know.
Absolutely. The smartest marketing people in the world are the ones that ask questions.
Yeah.
So that's I will always believe that.
I think, do you have time for one more question? It's like 7:40. Is it cutting close?
Let me just see.
Because if not, we could just do the sign off.
Cool. No, I'll do one more.
Okay, cool. Let me just make sure it's a good one. Make sure it's like a potent one. So this is like a kind of a heavy hitter.
Okay.
What is your most recent failure?
Oh, boy.
And maybe what did you learn from it?
Wow. Okay. My most recent failure. All right. Well, the one that stands out, probably because it was one of the most traumatic moments in my entire professional career. I can't name names, but I was setting up a record, and we had licensed a famous painter's artwork for the album artwork for this artist. And we had hired a third-party art director, so we weren't creating all the artwork in-house. We had hired a Grammy Award-winning, incredible art director who had verbal approval to use all of the imagery across the album cover, the inner sleeve, the back cover, all the assets we needed to launch this record. And the day before the record was to be announced and the world was going to see this artwork, I received a call from the painter's lawyer saying that we had no approvals, that we were not allowed to use this person's artwork, and then if we went out with the record, we were going to be sued. We were going to be in big trouble.
Yeah.
So that was about 9 in the morning, the day before the record was going to go
sweats.
Live.
Yes. That'll wake you up.
So I proceeded to spend the next, whatever it was, 12 hours running around with my hair on fire, trying to figure out how this happened, what do we do about it, how do we solve this problem. We ended up coming to an agreement at 11 p.m. Before the thing was seen on Spotify and iTunes and the pre-order was launched and everything. But in that panic, I learned a lot that day. But one of the main things I learned, and this goes for whether you're an artist, a manager, a booking agent, a record label exec, or a marketing person, is... any approvals you get them in writing. Have an email. An email is a legal binding document. An email saying, sure, that's cool, will actually stand up in court. You don't need a formal contract that's signed. So that was the biggest thing I learned that day was get it in writing. And the other thing I learned is no matter how insurmountable the problem seems, usually, always in my life, I have found this out. I'm 37 years old. I have faced some seemingly, you know, Herculean tasks in my personal and professional life. Somehow, there's always a solution. Somehow there's a way to find it out. Now it's rarely perfect. You can't make everyone happy, but in that morning I was like, I'm going to be fired. I've completely ruined this artist's career. I've ruined the rollout of this entire record. And by the end of the day, I just collapsed in a ball of sweat thinking like, wow, okay, somehow we made it through that. So get it in writing, and just know that there's usually some kind of solution to any problem, and you won't have to hurt anyone.
That's great. I think that's a good message to end on. That's nice. Good. Not too much of a downer. You made it through.
No, luckily I still have a job.
Yeah. There you go. You're talking to me right now. Cool. Thanks for coming through, man. Thank you. This was awesome.
My pleasure. Thanks to Kyle and you guys for having me.
Yeah, it was great to actually sit down with you and like find out your whole story and stuff.
Cheers.
I've known you for a while, but I haven't heard the full shebang.
Happy to share.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's our show. If you want to support our podcast, the best way to do that is to leave us a review on iTunes or Google Play. Again, we have our next panel on March 19th in downtown LA. For more details on how to attend, check our website at industrytalks.net. Thanks for listening.